Thank you for the invitation to come here and the opportunity to talk. So I'm going to talk about phosphorylations. It seems that I keep coming back to looking at phosphorylations in different systems. So I have three stories. The second one is with Peter Lenz, who's a physicist in Marburg. And then the last one, which is mainly what I'll talk about, is my recent work with my postdoc, who has his own group at Imperial, and with Steve Michnik's lab in Montreal, and with Mohan doing all the experiments. So I have three examples. This one we've already heard a little bit about, and I'll go through it quickly because most people might know about it. This is sort of kinetic proofreading thing. This is something looking at disordered proteins and how phosphorylations may play a role there. And this last part is looking at mating pathway in yeast. So on Monday we saw a very similar picture to this, looking at tRNA, specificity of translation. And this kinetic proofreading, which I'm going to talk about, was proposed in the early 70s, independently by Hopfield and Ninio, to try and explain how translation could be so specific, given the problems that we heard about with this wobble pairing and weak binding of incorrect tRNAs to the site here. So I'm going to come back to this. I mean, looking at it a priori, it's a little bit odd that you have this elongation factor which doesn't appear to do anything. Okay, so it comes, it binds here, burns GDP, and it falls off, and then the thing proceeds. The scheme proposed by, I'm more familiar with Hopfield's paper, is here and is more general. And the idea is that you're going to try and use the energy of phosphorylation to bring two specificity tests in the system. So I have my enzyme and its substrate, okay, and then they bind. And here, instead of going directly to the product, they go through this intermediate C1 stage. And this is where, this is an irreversible step, so some phosphorylation is being burned, going from here to here. And in this intermediate step, I have two choices. I can either form the product, or I can go down this what I call a discard pathway and reject the substrate, which then has to rebind and over here and go back through the pathway again. So the idea is that I have two substrates which have very similar structures. One is the correct substrate and one is the incorrect substrate. And they both have to go through this pathway. So we could have the two different tRNAs. And then we want to characterize how accurate, how specific the translation is. And we can do that by just looking at the ratio of the correct to incorrect product. And we can calculate that, and you can get this. You can show that this thing has a lower bond, and that lower bond is given by the square of the difference between the two binding energies, between the good product and the decoy, or the incorrect substrate and the correct substrate. Yeah. That's good. I'm going to come. Sure.
Can you explain a little bit the previous cartoon?
Yeah, so I'm going to come back to. I just went through a little bit quickly because I wanted to. So this was proposed before people knew what happened during translation. So people knew that there was a problem in the sense that binding of tRNAs was weak, was non-specific, but they didn't know then the question was, well, how could translation take place? And Hopfield proposed this scheme before the molecular details of what was going on were known. And I'm going to sort of go through this, and I'll come back and show how, in fact, what he proposes exactly what happens in the real system. I sort of haven't talked about this for a long time, so I'm looking a bit garbled. So we have two substrates. They're both competing for the enzyme. So I have a first specificity test here. Okay, so the correct substrate will bind to the enzyme slightly more strongly than the incorrect one. So I have one test there. Okay, so this, I'll come back to that. So then when I'm here, I burn ATP or GTP in some way to get me to this state. And here I have a second test. Okay, so the incorrect substrate this complex will be more unstable with the incorrect substrate and more likely to fall down this discard pathway than the correct substrate. Okay, and the importance of having using the phosphorylations is I force to, every substrate is forced to go to the second testing point. And when it goes down this pathway, I've written this as a one-way pathway, it can't go back up again. Okay, so it has, so when it falls down, it has to go back to the beginning, have the first test, then the second test again, and then it can finally be accepted. Okay, so but we're using the phosphorylations to make these two these steps irreversible.
Yeah. The important irreversible step is really B2.
So the discard. Yeah. So it's, but I'll come back. So it's really this. You're not allowed to go back up here, as you point out. Okay, because that allows you to cheat and avoid going through this first specificity test. Okay, so then we can do, you can do some calculations, as I said, calculate this ratio, and then you can sort of show that it's bounded below by twice the difference in energy between the two competing substrates, rather than just the difference in binding energy. So you're effectively increasing the specificity using the energy of the phosphorylations. Okay, so if I go, is that clear? Is there any more questions? Did I get it right? So if I go back to what actually happens, then this, we can understand, so here's the ribosome. So the tRNA comes in and binds. It could be correct or it could be incorrect. Then the elongation factor comes in, well, is with it. And this, we burn, here's an irreversible stem. So they've actually drawn, so I mean, here's an irreversible stem. It's come here, so I burn the GTP. In this state, I'm unstable, and I can fall, the tRNA can fall off, releasing the elongation factor at the same time. But because it's in the GDP state, I can't go back up the pathway. Okay, so this is here, and now I have a GDP elongation factor, and so I can't go back up here. I have to go back. The GDP has to exchange for GTP, and I have to go back to the beginning again and go through the pathway.
So what's the substrate
enzyme? So what I'm going to argue is that this, I mean, this was discussed for translation. So here the substrate of the tRNAs, and this is the end of the ribosome. Okay, so the elongation factor I'm kind of considering part of the enzyme, if you like. Okay, so but it'll work generally. Okay, so I could have any enzyme and any sort of series of substrates, as long as I go through this intermediate step and have this one-way discard pathway, then I'm going to be able to distinguish between competing substrates much better. Okay. So this was in the 70s. So our sort of small contribution was to realize that, well, many signal transduction proteins, particularly I'll talk about kinases, you need two phosphorylations before the thing becomes active. Okay, so the question is, well, why have two phosphorylations rather than just one? And then, given what I just talked about, we can think about, well, can we use this extra phosphorylation to increase the specificity in these pathways? So now I'm going to talk about the specificity of the kinase, so the protein that's going to phosphorylate the kinase, and it has to phosphorylate the kinase twice for the kinase to become active. So if we assume just one phosphorylation is required, which is shown here, so here I have my substrate, the kinase, form a complex, phosphorylate, falls apart, releasing the kinase, and I have a phosphatase which removes the phosphate and brings me back to the beginning again. Okay, and then my decoy kinase, so let's say a kinase from a different pathway which I shouldn't be activating in some sense, goes through exactly the same process. The only difference is that here, because it binds with a less favorable binding energy, so I'm going to assume that this discard rate is bigger than this one. Okay, so they're coming, let's say, diffusion limited, and the discard is larger here than here. Okay, then I can go ahead and do all this and just calculate the error fraction, the sort of error, the ratio of the correct to incorrect, and I get something just given by the ratio of the difference between the two binding energies, as you might expect. Okay, so then if I say, well, hang on, the real system, we do have these two phosphorylations. So the kinase binds the substrate, get a complex, it phosphorylates once, phosphorylates again, and it's only when it's here that I can go ahead and form the completed active kinase, okay? Which again can go back with the phosphatase. And so we have to assume, if we assume that in this intermediate step where I have just been phosphorylated once, that the enzyme or the kinase can release the kinase, which then is dephosphorylated, then I have an irreversible discard pathway. Okay, so it's crucial that we have phosphatases there to remove the phosphate and prevent an incorrect kinase from coming sneaking up this way. Yep.
Is does anyone else remotely confused about what phosphorylation is?
Oh. Probably just you. So you're really just taking a phosphate group and sticking it, attaching it to the protein with a covalent bond. So it's an energetic process.
And it's related to that's something that happens after the protein's been. That's after it's been translated.
So this protein's floating around in the cytosol, and then something happens. Let's say that in the case I'm going to talk about, mating pheromone is detected. Okay, and then this protein is going to then be the signal to the rest of the cell that they've seen mating pheromone. And that happened. It becomes active, and it gets phosphorylated in some way, which changes its conformation, and it's able to do things, which is then a signal.
That happens when it's coming out of the ribosome.
No, there's no translation. This could be there for a long period of time, just waiting around for the signal, whatever signal it's going to respond to arrive. So there's one which responds to osmotic stress or something in yeast.
Nothing to do with translation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that was the confusion. I'm sorry. Yeah.
In this case, the conformational change seems to be very localized and rather small.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure someone here can tell you better how this works, but I mean, this you phosphorylate this lip and it moves up and then it exposes some region where the substrates can come in, which before is blocked, but in some vague sense. I know, some confusion here. So what I'm trying to argue is that this idea was proposed to understand translation, but I want to argue that the same thing can perhaps occur in many different places, because in many places you have this extra phosphorylation that's taking place that doesn't appear to have an obvious purpose. Sorry, okay. And so one example is here, where this, you can imagine I could just phosphorylate this once, and then it would become active. But yeah, so for some reason I need to. Yeah, sorry, okay. And so the argument is that if with just one I have this poor specificity, if there's some sort of decoy kinase from a different pathway I don't want to activate, and with two I do much better and I get the square of this. Okay. And that's because I have this, again, I have one test here where the two different substrates compete for the enzyme, and then I have a second test here where the bad substrate is more unstable and it's more likely to go down this pathway. And because I have a phosphorylations, this step is irreversible, and so the incorrect substrate can't go back up this way. Okay, so the energy is, in physics sense, energy is being used. It's not futile, as it's often referred to in biology, but it's being used to potentially increase specificity, providing this part is unstable, where I have one phosphorylation site. Okay, so that's a very simple idea, and that's all I want to say about that, really. So when I talked about kinases, but this is just showing that the many receptors and proteins in signal transduction go through multiple phosphorylation. So I forget, this is insulin pathway or something, but here the receptor gets activated, has two phosphorylations. Whatever this is, PTB binds to it, has multiple phosphorylations. This protein then gets excited, has two phosphorylations, et cetera, et cetera. So that many different proteins in these pathways go through many phosphorylations, and clearly I'll talk about other reasons why they might want to do that. But one consequence potentially could be because they're increasing specificity of the pathway. But some disadvantages are that because I have this discard pathway where things are getting shuttled down, the time to reach steady state gets much longer, and also the amount of active complex I get at the end is much lower, okay, because I'm constantly recycling stuff. So it's not, if you can imagine, if I want to be really specific, I could have, say, six or seven phosphorylations, but then the amount of stuff that I get at the end, of active stuff I get at the end, is a very small percentage of what I started with, because I'm simply just getting rid of it all. So in that sense, it becomes presumably there's some sort of balance that's been met between how much substrate you make and how specific you want to be. Okay. So is that, any more questions on that? Okay. So it's quite, yeah. And if people are interested, there's lots of other nice examples that I have some references and things to. So there's things for proofreading of cargo vesicles, for folding of proteins, for untangling DNA, I should say, and other things. It's believed that this principle, this idea is working. Okay, the second example, which is another shorter one, is inspired by this observation by Mike Tyers' group, where the details of what this protein is aren't too important, but there's some protein, SYK1, and it turns out to have 9 phosphorylation sites. And what's very strange is it has to be phosphorylated on at least 6 of them before it goes ahead and binds its target. And it doesn't matter which 6. Okay, so it has these 9 sites. So they did various experiments. So this is shown here. So here's some in vitro. So if you look at this column, with 2 phosphorylations, it's not bound. 3, it's not bound. 5, it's not bound. And 6, it's bound. Different. This 1 and 2 means different configurations of 6 proteins. And it binds 7, et cetera. Okay, it binds here. And this is true in the wild type as well. So this protein's involved in the cell cycle. So if they remove some of the phosphorylation sites, the thing gets stuck in the cell cycle. So here they prevent, they only allow up to 5 phosphorylations to take place, and nothing, the cells don't grow. But then as soon as they have 6, and again, it doesn't matter which 6, the cells can grow. Okay, so it's a puzzle that it's just about how this thing could potentially be working. I think they moved them around as well. So I think did they do that? I don't think so. I can't remember. But what's the crucial thing? Part interesting thing that I think is coming next. I believe they sort of played with something somehow. They did something like that. So it's a function of the number of phosphorylations. The fraction of SYK1 that's bound is goes through this sigmoidal curve, where basically it's 0, and then around 6 it binds, and then it's fully bound. I have SYK1, floats around the cytosol. When it's phosphorylated 6 or more times, it binds to its target, which is, so it gets degraded in some way. So it's binding to this, it's a CDC4 protein, that's not too important. But it needs 6 phosphorylations to bind. So if I plot the fraction of bound SYK1 versus the number of phosphorylations, I get some kind of sharp sigmoidal type curve.
Is it very specific kinase, or?
You mean its targets? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think I see where your question's going, but I can't remember. I should know what it does. I mean, it inhibits one of the CDKs. I can't remember which one, but I think it's G1. And the G1's not part of the cell cycle. Okay. As everyone knows here, to talk about binding, we need to worry about both energy and entropy. So we look at the free energy. And what was interesting to us is it turns out that this protein is an intrinsically disordered protein. So I think it's sort of 80% of it is predicted to not have a structure. So it's sort of fluctuating in space. And because of that, we thought, well, the entropic term that's usually ignored when you think about how things, free energy of binding, may become important. Okay, so we potentially have a large conformational entropy of this thing because it's disordered and fluctuating in space. So the idea is that which is pretty fine. So this, because it's disordered, has a protein SYK1 has a high conformational entropy when it's in free space. When it binds to its partner, it has a lower conformational entropy. Maybe it folds in some way, or it certainly is restricted in how it can fluctuate. We can I'm going to define conformational entropy just by the number of configurations available, the log of that. And then what we sort of predict or assume is that what these phosphorylations can do is they can impose some kind of local structure on the protein. Okay, so this is a 2D example. So we have a disordered protein, so it's just a polymer doing a self-avoiding walk. And then when it's phosphorylated, we assume that forces a kink in the polymer structure, so that you're bringing in this charge, and for some reason that causes there are lots of examples where that causes some local structure in the protein, and we're going to model that by forcing it to have a kink where each of these phosphorylations are these red sites. Mm-hmm. And then we can calculate the conformation entropy of those states. So just to sort of give some intuition. So this is, again, it's just a 2D example, but we have our polymer. We do 100, generate 100 configurations, and I impose them as a cloud. So impose them all on top of each other, and I get this kind of cloud shape. And then if I do the same thing where we've, I forget, is it six, where we have six phosphorylation sites, we force six sort of right angle kinks into the protein conformation, the number of conformation is much less. Okay. And you can see that pictorially by the size of this cloud being reduced. And we can do that more systematically. So there's sort of a lot on here. So but first of all, if you just look at this curve. So this is here I'm plotting here the number of conformations that's on this axis as a function of the number of phosphorylations. Okay, and this is in log space. This is log of the number of conformations. So the number of conformations drops quite quickly as I increase the number of phosphorylations, and it does so in a non-linear way. Okay, because I have a self-avoiding walk. The more kinks I add, the harder the number of conformations I can take. It gets fewer and fewer, and it doesn't do it in a linear way. So then if we go ahead and calculate, include this in our, this configuration of entropy in our free energy and calculate the amount of A that's bound, the amount of sic 1 that's bound to the protein, then we have this conformational entropy enters that term. So if this is zero, I get just the standard result. This is just the KD over the amount of the partner B. And if I have a lot of conformational entropy, then the amount of A that's bound is zero. As you might expect. If there's lots of conformational entropy, when it's free in solution or in the cytosol, it's not going to want to bind to the protein and lose all that conformational entropy. Or is yeah, so that's the next slide. So what are we doing? We're doing a three-dimensional random walk. We just run it. We just calculate the number of conformations. We add a phosphorylation somewhere which kinks it, which forces a right angle in that place, and we just recalculate the number of conformations. And we just do that as a function of the number of phosphorylations that we have. Okay, and of course, if the polymer is very short, it doesn't matter. If it's very long, it's more important.
You used the word just in that sentence. Calculating full-blown conformational entropy even is not the trigger.
Yeah, so we have sort of 15 units or 20. It's a very small polymer.
Okay.
So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so we just do it, or we just simulate long enough and just count them up.
Or 10 is okay, or 100 is absolutely okay.
Yeah, we can't do that. Yeah.
I think this depends on which sites you choose to phosphorylate, how close.
I guess that was Boris' question. It does to some extent. I thought we played with that, and we didn't see, unless you cluster them all together, that you don't see a significant effect. But it will do. Yeah. Any more questions? People look still very positive. Sorry?
The starting point of your polynomial, how well it's random distributed.
So so our polymers are very short. I think the longest we do is maybe 15 or 17 monomers. So we just count all the possible configurations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we just count them all, and then when we add a phosphorylation, we have a kink, and we just count again what the number of conformations is, and so on.
Question: how do the standard scaling results do? Even at 10, they might do quite well. You know, with the gamma z to the n.
Yeah, at the time I didn't know there were standard scaling results, so I would be interested to see. So because with the kinks, right? So I mean, for the free one, I didn't.
Kinks, so you have fewer effective links.
But again, I guess it depends where the kinks are. So I don't know whether the scaling results.
How does this?
Yeah, we didn't check. Yeah, we looked a little bit for things like that, but we didn't at the time.
In my case, sometimes.
Yeah, I shouldn't. Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I can. Okay, so that's fine. What this curve means. So then we just do a calculation with the free energy, and we can calculate the amount of a bind polymer that we have. And again, it's not, now depends on this conformational entropy, and as you expect, this is very large, the bind is very small. So then we just do that for a different amount of kinks, and we get all these different curves here. So these, as I move, so this is, and this is, I'm looking at this axis, the fraction of bind protein versus the number of phosphorylation sites, and we're doing that as I move this way, I'm changing this variable. Okay, so I'm increasing the binding energy. Okay, so what do you see? So first of all, it's not very nonlinear because we have this self-avoiding walk and these kinks makes it very nonlinear. We get very sigmoidal responses. Okay, so it seems to describe, at least phenomenologically, what we're seeing in the data. So we can easily get one where nothing happens in around six. Well, maybe here is better. Around six, it binds very, very tightly. Intuitively, again, if the binding energy is very high, so this blue curve, then the number of phosphorylations we need before it binds is much lower. If the binding energy is smaller, then we need many more phosphorylations because we have to reduce the conformational entropy a lot before it will choose to bind. Okay, everyone, that's...
Yep. The phosphorylations, are they moving around or is it quenched?
So the polymer is free to fluctuate. Where the phosphorylations are on the polymer is fixed. They're in fixed positions.
So it doesn't seem to increase the steepness of this.
It does. If you fit things to it, it does. Okay. Yeah, maybe it doesn't look very good on this plot. The question in some sense is fair because the Hill coefficients are all very high. Okay, so.
What's constant on each of those curves?
The length of the polymer.
So you get different lengths.
Here I've kept the length fixed and I've changed the binding energy to its partner. So as I increase the binding energy moving this way, I need fewer phosphorylations for binding to occur. Okay, because the and then the next graph is doing what you suggested, where I now change the length of the polymer and ask how things change there. And again, if the polymer is very very small, then for the binding energy I've chosen, it binds immediately. And as it gets larger, again, I see this type of effect. Okay. Forrest, you look in pain. Is it?
No, I guess I'm just sort of trying to understand how this gas is presumably for very long chains, the effect would go away in the sense that you will require a number of phosphorylations of scales of length.
Well, I guess also you could argue that maybe the region that's affected by the phosphorylation is also scales with the length or something. But you can get around it in some way.
Well, you say that ultimately maybe sort of the number of segments.
Well, exactly. This
actually is not very large.
Yeah.
But if one takes this face value, then so are there other proteins that get phosphorylated even on more sites? And now there are these papers from Gunnar Den.
Isn't P53 is 17 or something like this? Is 17 phosphorylations sites? But
so is that thing unstructured?
Well, that's the thing. So it turns out that there is a correlation. So the coefficient, I don't know how strong it is, but if you talking to various biochemists, it's often the region that gets phosphorylated is disordered. And the phosphorylation, partly because the phosphorylation is going to come and cause a configuration change, and so they think there has to be some flexibility there.
Is there a sense in which that's a longer region?
I looked for proteins that have many phosphorylations, and then there's some bioinformatics stuff which will then tell you, predict how disordered, what percentage disordered they are. And it was not difficult to come up with five or six examples which had many phosphorylations and which had sort of over 50% predicted disordered region. So, but other than that, I haven't done anything more systematic. Yeah.
You can say something about how should predict also the number of phosphorylations affects the ability of the kinase that phosphorylates the SYK1 to recognize what it's
like. Yeah, this is exactly what, when I talked about this, I only talked about this once before in this book I asked. So, there's something there. They could argue perhaps that the binding energy there is different or something, so this is not perhaps so important. Why it wants to do it? I mean, there is another explanation that we're using charge. Okay, so it's possible that for SYK1 it doesn't quite work that way. But in terms, I guess the point what I'm trying to make is that we should this entropic term in the free energy is nearly always ignored, and perhaps there's some interesting things come out if we think about that a bit more. Yeah.
You have a prediction.
If it can be done. The other thing we thought we could do is we could fuse two together, and that would increase the size of this disordered region, and then we would have some prediction about how the number of phosphorylations would change. But Mike, Mike is not my colleague, but they want to do this, so yeah.
But somehow you're saying that phosphorylation here and there, phosphorylation is doing something generic.
sometimes.
Yeah, so yeah, that's yeah.
So some protein that does something very specific.
Yeah, so the generic part is important here because it doesn't matter. It's just a number. It doesn't matter where they are or which six are phosphorylated. So that's that. Okay, so I move on to the final example. Okay, so this is how we think in this system at least that phosphorylations are making the system more robust to changes in chemical concentration. And the system we're looking at is the mating response in yeast. So this is the work with Steve Michnik's group. So here, this is a sort of very canonically studied pathway, or canonical pathway. So there's three MAP kinases, as we talked about earlier. There's a G protein that detects pheromone, and it causes these kinases to be activated, and the last kinase then moves into the nucleus and causes new gene expression. What's interesting about the pathway is that the kinases are assembled on what's called a scaffold. So there's some protein that, if you like, sort of increases their local concentration and is bound by all three of them. And what we're going to talk about a lot is the role that this scaffold plays. So even by the name scaffold, it's sort of thought of as a passive, often thought of as a passive participant in the signal transduction. It's just there, as I said, to sort of increase local concentrations. But for this system, we're going to argue against that.
Is it a single protein, the scaffold, or should we think of a protein complex?
The actual scaffold itself is a single protein, but it can bind these other three. So in that sense, it's a protein complex. There are some evidence that these proteins dimerize with themselves, and so then you start to get these big complexes, and that might be taking place.
Is the binding of the three cooperative or anti-cooperative, or is it?
I don't know. Okay. So the naive conception is that before a pheromone arrives, these guys are all bound to here, and it's just sitting there ready to go. Okay. And then it just speeds up. So this binds, then you can quickly phosphorylate this one, and then this can be released and go off and do its job. I don't know. That's sort of typically how they're discussed. Whether anyone's tested that carefully, I don't know. Okay, so here's just to show what happens. So this is a nice movie from Seagal's lab, and here they come in with a pipette. These are yeast cells. They put a lot of pheromone here, and then you can see how the cells, what's called shmoo towards the source of the pheromone. Okay, so they're just single cells, but they're just growing towards where the pheromone is put on. Play it again. Okay, so this is way, way, way too much pheromone, so they really, really want to mate. So you can see, okay, so they're sort of growing. This is a sort of the shmoo effect is something that we quantified. So as you increase the pheromone, the cells sort of move through these morphological stages. Okay, so initially they're just growing normally. This is its axial budding. So the bud, I have a nice movie, but the yeast cells, it's essentially like the daughter cell comes out like someone's blowing up a balloon. You sort of see this thing sort of slowly grow out. And it occurs around the periphery. When they sense some pheromone, then they start to bud in this bipolar way. So from one of the ends. So they start to sort of, they look like they're beginning to form chains. When there's enough pheromone, then they you can interpret it like they think that a mate is sufficiently close, and they go into cell cycle arrest to get themselves ready, and then they start to shmoo in the direction where the pheromone is strongest, where they think the mate is. Okay, and typically the shmoos look something like this, not those much longer ones that were shown in the movie. And so what Mohan did was to look at some cells under the microscope with different amounts of alpha factor, and just quantify the fraction that were in these different states. And I'm going to just focus on the colors here correspond to the colors up here. And I just want to focus on the red. So that's the fraction of cells that are in the shmooing state. So that initially there's very little, and then around this sort of critical threshold, suddenly there's most of the cells are shmooing. Okay, and we can sort of fit a Hill coefficient to this, a Hill function to this, and we get this high Hill coefficient. Okay, So then the question is, can we understand where that high Hill coefficient is coming from, given what we know about the pathway here? And the crucial experiment that Mohan did was to use this mutant of the sterol 5 scaffold that no longer binds those three, the last kinase. Okay, so if we have that mutant in, then you see immediately that we get a much more gradual response in the fraction of cells that are shmooing. And you can quantify that. So then to probe further, Steve's lab has developed this assay, which they call PCA, this protein fragment complementation assay. And to me, it's amazing that it works. But if they want to know if two proteins are interacting, they take luciferase and they break it into two and fuse two halves to each of the two proteins. If the proteins interact, then magically luciferase will refold into its correct conformation. And then they can, using bioluminescence, they can detect this in cells or actually in populations of cells. You can do this with GFPs as well, and it works fine. But the problem with GFPs is once the GFP is made this is refolded, it doesn't. You can't break the proteins apart again. Luciferase, for some reason, is nice, and the proteins will unbind, and this will go back into this state reasonably happily. Again, amazingly. So this is sort of the assay we use. The weakness is that because this signal from luciferase is small, we have to look at populations of cells. So we can't look at individual cells. So what we did was then to sort of start to probe the different interactions that are present here using this assay. And the one I'm going to focus on is between FOS3 and the scaffold sterol 5. So that's shown here, these blue dots. So this is basically the amount of complex that we see. So higher up here, we see more FOS3 with sterol 5. And this is, again, versus pheromone, the amount of alpha factor. And again, so the interaction between FOS3 and sterol 5 itself seems to be a sigmoidal function of alpha factor. So initially it's bound, which is a critical value of alpha factor, and then suddenly it's in it, then it's released. If we look at some mutants, so this is that sterol 5 ND mutant, the one where it doesn't dock. Okay, so then we shouldn't see any signal, and indeed we don't see any signal. Okay, so there's no sterol 5, this interaction doesn't take place. What's also interesting is if we look at a kinase dead form of FOS3, then we see some interaction, which is small, but the interaction doesn't change as a function of alpha factor. So it seems that the kinase properties of FOS3, its ability to phosphorylate, is contributing towards this generating the sigmoidal curve in some way. Okay, because if you remove that, we lose the sigmoidal. Okay?
People have checked carefully that the kinase dead has the same affinity for sterol 5 and such.
Yeah, maybe. I'm sure they've done something like this, but I don't know. I mean, from our point of view, we're not too worried about where this lies, as long as it's there and it's not changing. Okay, presumably it's a bit less. Well, there's a difference between here and here, but we know why that is. Okay, so if it binds with the same affinity, naively you'd expect these two things to be at the same level, but there's a reason why that's not there. But which is here. Okay, so it's known, Wendell Lim's group have known that sterol 5, sorry, FOS3 binds to sterol 5, it becomes partially active, so just one of these phosphorylation sites becomes phosphorylated. And then when it does that, it phosphorylates sterol 5. At that time, it was known to be once, and that then increases its binding energy. So that's why that we saw that difference, or one reason why you see that difference here. Okay, because FOS3 binds to sterol 5 and phosphorylates it, and then its binding energy increases, which is why there's a difference between these two curves. What Mohan noticed was that if you do some simple bioinformatics, you can actually see that there's four phosphorylation sites, potential phosphorylation sites on this protein, not just the one that was noticed by Wendell Lim's group.
How did he do this by?
I don't know, actually. So he did it. I mean, he must use some standard tool because he's
related yeast species also have four phosphorylation sites on the same log of sterol 5.
I don't know. So what we do know is that we check that they're there and they're there. Okay. So that's how you find them now is irrelevant, somewhat irrelevant. But I don't know. I mean, I should know. And they're all the things that they're clustered quite close together as well. So it's I guess it's just some standard sequence of amino acid sequence they're expecting to see, and that's what they look like. So then what we can do is we can play with these phosphosites, and we can remove them, so we can replace them by, I think it's serine by alanine and threonine by valine, but anyway, replace them by other amino acids, and then use our assay to look at the interaction between FOS3 and sterol 5, so the last kinase in the scaffold, and ask, well, how does it change? And so this is with and without alpha factor. Okay, so let's look at the ones without alpha factor first. Okay, so initially this is the wild type, so we have a strong interaction. And as we remove phosphocytes, the level of the interaction falls. Okay, and eventually if you remove all of them, we get very close to this non-binding form. Okay, so there's a slight difference here. When I add alpha factor, we see the same general effect. Okay, so that the amount of complex that we see decreases as we remove phosphorylation sites from the sterile 5. Okay, this is consistent with the idea proposed by Wendell Lim's group, that the kinase binds, becomes partially active, and then phosphorylates these sites, which increases its binding energy. Okay, and the more sites you have, the stronger that increase in binding energy is. And in fact, of course, we can quantify it looking at these data.
Is the signal going down when you add alpha factor?
Because FIS3 is being released it's being released and going off into the nucleus to do stuff. Okay, so this, right, so it's...
But, I mean, doesn't that make you wonder, if signal going down is what it's supposed to do, then if it goes down more when you take off phosphorylation sites, is that a sign it's not working, or is it a sign of something else?
Well, I mean, it's getting to the state where it's almost always free. So we can do the opposite. Okay, so now we can remove all the phosphorylation sites and we can put back active ones. Okay, so glutamic acid, which looks like a phosphorylation site, it's got a charge. So here's the wild type. Okay, so again, when we add pheromone, it drops because the FIS3 is released. We start off with zero phosphorylation sites, nothing happens. Okay, let's look at the without alpha factor. Then as we add the phosphorylation sites back in, and remember they're phosphorylated, the amount of complex we see gets higher and higher. Okay, so again, this idea that having phosphorylated residues there increases the binding of sterile 5 in some way. But now what's different is that as we add alpha factor, there's no change. Okay, so by making these phosphorylation sites always on or always phosphorylated, the system is unable to respond to alpha factor, at least at the level of interaction between the kinase and the scaffold. Okay, does that? Okay, so we know that to generate this sigmoidal interaction behavior that we saw, we need this kinase to be active, and we also know that we need something that's going to be able to remove the phosphorylations that the kinase makes. Okay, otherwise we have this type of behavior where alpha factor doesn't change anything. Okay, so the next thing that we did was we looked through all the phosphatases in use, of which there's 6, and asked which one changed things. And there is one, and it's PTC1, and we can see that if you knock out this phosphatase, then the interaction between FIS3 and sterile 5 as a function of alpha factor is unchanged. Okay, this is like our constitutively phosphorylated protein. And we can ask whether PTC1 is recruited to the scaffold, and as a function of alpha factor, it is. Okay, so it seems that as you add alpha factor, so what's happening is that the kinase initially binds to the scaffold, it phosphorylates all these 4 sites, and becomes much more strongly bound. Then as we add alpha factor, PTC1 comes in and starts to dephosphorylate the sites, presumably, which allows the kinase to be released. Okay, so we sort of have those two ingredients. We have a phosphatase and a kinase, and we have a sigmoidal response. So how do we get that sigmoidal response? And there's a famous paper from Goldbeater and Koshlin, which is one way of generating that. Okay, this is zero order. They call it zero order also sensitivity. And it comes from this competition between a kinase and a phosphatase. So people may know this, but I'm just going to walk through it. So to get an intuition of what's going on, here's a kinase acting on a substrate, so it adds a phosphocyte, and I can ask at the rate of production of the substrate as a function of the percentage of phosphorylated substrate. Okay, so what does this mean? So this means that over here I have everything is in the W state, over here is all in the W star state, so the rate at which I make W star is biggest here, and it falls as there's less and less W available. Okay. I can do the same thing for a phosphatase. Okay, so then it has its maximum rate when there's lots of W star, and then falls as the amount of W star disappears. And if I have those two things acting together, then where those two curves intersect gives me the steady state amount of phosphorylated W. Okay. Right. So what's happening in our system is that the the level of phosphatase is changing as a function of alpha factor. So if I vary this curve, we can ask how the steady state changes as a function of the phosphatase. So I can start here, and then if I slowly increase the amount of phosphatase, you sweep out this curve, and I can just take those points and plot them here. So this is as a function of the pheromone, in which it changes the amount, increases the amount of phosphatase, and I get this curve swept out here, which is not sigmoidal. And then, actually, I don't need to go on there yet. So then the insight from Goldbeater and Koshner was, is if I, instead of having my enzymes acting like this, I have saturated enzymes. Okay, so that for most of the levels of substrate that I'm working at their maximum rate, then I get a very different type of curve. So I do the same thing. So I have start over here, and then I increase the amount of phosphatase. And you can see that the level of W star doesn't change very much. Okay, and then suddenly it changes, and then it stays roughly around the same level. Okay, so if I do that systematically, then I get a much more sigmoidal response. So initially it doesn't change, and then it does change suddenly, and I'm right on the other end. Okay, so that's one way of generating a sigmoidal response. So I have to have my kinase and the phosphatase competing for the same substrate, but they're both working near saturation, okay, which makes those curves have that this very characteristic flat regions, which gives me this sigmoidal character. So that's what we thought. Okay, so with a sort of a very well-known method, so we have all the ingredients. We have a kinase, we have a phosphatase, we have the same substrate. We've proven that they're all doing the right things. The problem is if we look in what's expected in vivo, the concentration of the kinase is much more than the concentration of the scaffold. Okay, so this sort of, these are approximate numbers. So that's exactly the opposite of what we wanted, okay, because we want the kinase to be saturated, when in fact it doesn't appear to be. So it turns out for this system, and in fact for many systems, when a kinase binds to its substrate, it does in two stages. First of all, it binds a docking site on the substrate, and then once it's bound to the docking site, then it's able to access the phosphorylation site or enzymatic site of what it's going to do. So that's sort of, if we include that, then we see some interesting things. So that's just sort of shown here. So here's the substrate. Here's the kinase. So it comes in, binds. This is the active site, and this is the site that binds to the docking site on the sterol 5. Comes in, binds, and then once it's bound, it can access these phosphorylation sites. So the observation is that this is this two-stage binding creates or has the potential to create a local saturation of the enzyme. Okay, so if it shown here, so here's sterol 5 with its four phosphorylation sites. The kinase comes in and it binds, and then this individual kinase on this sterol 5 is saturated, okay, because it has four potential phosphorylation sites it can choose to bind to activate. Okay, so it binds here, then it moves onto the active into the region where it's able to access the active sites, and then when it's here, it's locally saturated because of the four phosphorylations. And because of this two-stage step, you get some decoupling from what's happening in the cytosol. So the cytosolic concentration isn't what's determining the saturation of the enzyme. It's what's happening locally at each individual sterol 5. And we can argue that the phosphatase does the same thing. So it binds to its docking site, then it can move on to one of the to try and dephosphorylate one of the phosphorylation sites and take it to here. But again, when it's here, it's in a saturated regime. It's four times the concentration is four of its substrate is four times the concentration of the local of the enzyme. And we sort of do that, you know, so we build up a big model where with all the four phosphorylation sites and let it do all this stuff. So we have a kinase and a phosphatase. So when we do that, we can fit the data. So here's that sigmoidal curve I showed right at the beginning, so we can fit that easily. What's more interesting is that we see the sort of robust behavior coming on. So if we assume there was just one phosphorylation site on sterol 5, then we can use the standard zero order also sensitivity proposed by Goldbeater and Koshland. And then we see, so this is lots of stuff here. So here I'm plotting the function of the substrate versus the concentration of the substrate versus the concentration of the kinase. And each point on here is the Hill number for this type of curve. Okay, so we picked a substrate in kinase concentration. We varied the amount of alpha factor in our simulations. We got some response curve, and we fitted that, and we got a Hill number. Okay, so so over here, this is the regime where there's much more kinase and substrate. So that's the regime where the zero order sensitivity shouldn't work. And indeed, it's all blue, which is has a low Hill number. Okay, the Hill number happens to be around 2 because of the way because the phosphatase is recruited with a Hill number of 2. But it doesn't. The point is it's very low. And this is the region where we believe that the concentrations in the real system are around. And it's only when you get into the saturated regime where you have much more substrate than kinase that you get these high Hill numbers appearing. If you do the same thing now with our with this two-stage binding, and where we have 4 phosphorylation sites, then the picture completely changes, and it's everywhere, at least on these scales, has a very high Hill function. Okay, so adding the phosphorylations means that the concentrations of the kinase to the ratio of the concentration of the substrate to the kinase becomes much less important, or the system is robust to that. And that's again because this two-stage binding and the multiple phosphorylation sites create this local saturation of the enzymes. Yeah.
I'm a little confused. So don't you need some kind of synchronization here now? I mean, you're individually having each scaffold sort of acting like a switch, but you have many of them in the cell, and there might be.
Well, the level of pheromone, in a sense, synchronizes them all. Okay, because so the amount of phosphatase we can dial up and down as we change the amount of pheromone. So it's sort of a more deterministic situation. So the prediction is that because we have this two-stage binding with the multiple phosphorylation sites, we can create local saturation and we can generate this sigmoidal character, which is robust to the concentrations of the substrates and enzymes. So we can verify some of these things experimentally. So this is data where we, which I've shown you before already. So this is again the first 3-sterol-5 interaction versus alpha factor. This is the original blue curve. The green curve is the one where if we knock out the phosphatase, okay, so then we don't see a sigmoidal response anymore. The kinase is stuck on the scaffold. If we add a plasmid, so we increase the amount of the phosphatase manyfold, then we see some change. And looking at the red curve, so that the steepness of the curve doesn't change as we predict, though the threshold changes a little bit. Okay, so we can go in and artificially mess around with these concentrations and show that the sigmoidal character remains the same. The other thing that we can do is we can go back to the mutants that Mohan made, and we can start to pull out the phosphorylation sites. So our prediction would be that as we reduce the number of phosphorylation sites, so taking 1, 2, 3, and 4, then that local saturation effect happening on the scaffold becomes less and less important, or it disappears. And we see that exactly in the data. So the wild type with 4 phosphorylation sites, we see a less sigmoidal response as we reduce each of the as we take away those phosphorylations. What's even more surprising is that it's a slightly different plot, but this is, if I go back to the fraction of cells that are schmewing as a function of alpha factor, the sigmoidal characters of those responses also changes in the correct way as we reduce the this is sort of, again, it's taking away phosphocytes in different ways. So that sigmoidal character of the first 3-sterol-5 interaction really determines the sigmoidal character of the smearing response of the morphological change much further downstream. Okay, so to finish there, so we've sort of shown that the decision to mate occurs early in the pathway, mating pathway. It's up here somewhere, because this is where we get the sigmoid response generated. The scaffold is definitely an active component in the pathway. It's not just passive. And because it has multiple phosphorylations, we create this robust sigmoidal response that is insensitive to some extent to the concentrations of the components of the pathway. And that's where I'm going to finish. So 3 examples where the energy built into phosphorylations is can be exploited by the cell. You can get this sort of specificity that's proposed by Hopfield originally. You can perhaps sort of not care about the details of the biochemistry in the sense of where the phosphorylation sites are using this disordered model, intrinsic disorder portion I talked about. And also you can create this robustness to concentrations. And then just to reiterate, so that the disordered SIC1 study was done by with Peter. And then Vahid did the modeling, and Mohan did the experiments, and it was a collaboration with Steve Michnet's group when we looked at the mating response. Okay, thank you.
I got lost somewhere along the way. When you change the alpha factor concentration, so you're changing the activity of one of the enzymes?
We're changing the local concentration of the enzyme. So as a function of alpha factor, the amount of PTC1 at sterile 5 increases.
Okay, and the activity of the plus 3 stays constant, you cross.
So when you say robustness to concentrations, you meant that the Hill coefficient doesn't really depend on the concentration, but the point where you switch from one behavior to the other does.
Yes, so the threshold of the curve will change.
Which is sweeping, where they match up just instead of different concentrations.
But this sort of sharp response, which translates to the morphological response, doesn't seem to matter on the concentrations. At the pheromone level, where it does, what should change a little bit, but not the sharpness.
In this story, what's the function of the MAP kinase cascade?
In this story, none as yet. Okay, so
you're going to account for all of these curves just by this last.
We just looked at this just the last. So in our model, all we have is just the scaffold and the kinase and the phosphatase. So it's just that last stage that we picked out.
The SIC1 nine phosphorylation sites thing. Again, are there versions of it bioinformatically with 4, 5, 6? Can you find the intermediate steps in this?
It's possible. One thing that, as I said already, it seems to be generic is that phosphorylation sites tend to be in disordered regions of proteins.
Okay.
For whatever reason.
So I'm so tempted to ask what you don't know. I mean, it's a very lovely story, but where you present it is sort of rather neat, and I'm wondering what we don't know about this.
What's underneath the rug? So what we've fudged over is sort of, I can sort of show here. So we've talked about, I talk about when this is released, but we haven't really, also getting at what Mukhen was asking, I haven't talked about how it gets phosphorylated twice. Okay, so when it binds initially without alpha factor, it becomes partially phosphorylated in some way. Then it phosphorylates the scaffold, and then we just say it's released in our model. But it has to be phosphorylated by sterol 7, and other things have to happen, and that we haven't modeled. So we need to include that in some way.
And I was also wondering about, as Mukund, I think, hinted at evolutionary routes to this sort of recruitment of phosphorylation everywhere. Another one I'm familiar with that's sort of related here because it's a transmembrane operation as well is the bacterial chemotaxis receptor cluster in coli, where there's some rather interesting phosphorylation, actually multiple phosphorylation sites on the transmembrane alpha helix bundles. Double bundles that is thought to, but I still don't, as far as I'm aware, you can correct me, people aren't really sure of the mechanism, but there the issue is, of course, the renormalization of the detection equipment of the bacterium to the absolute signal. I mean, this exquisite mechanism needs to detect relative concentration gradients.
What's the relation to methylation?
It's a covalent modification.
Methylation there. So I think it is. I'm sorry, I got confused. Right. So there's. That's true. It's not. It is methylation, but it's kind of well.
It's a same. Just, it's
the same class.
So isn't it the same?
How much energy is used? I don't know. How does?
Is it just the energy that makes it?
Well, my understanding is simple. Yeah.
Because once the protein is able to react, because why don't you have phosphorylation and methylation when the protein becomes covalently alpha? I mean, there are cases that it's going to happen, but once you're able to sense phosphorylation, you might want to. Your kinase is already there. You want to keep on.
If you think an electrostatic story, then the question is clearly very different.
Exactly. How it actually influences the protein.
Thanks.
Thank you. No talk on Friday. The other thing is, Joseph.